unanimously. By creating that threshold for his ongoing involvement, he forced the stakeholders to focus on the underlying difficult question. Would they be willing to work collaboratively at the expense of their treasured autonomy? Once they passed that difficult first vote, they would have already begun the process of figuring out how to work together. Kelly worked as an academic administrator in Colorado and participated actively in the Denver civic and political community. After an 8-year tenure, she left her job as a staff member for the Denver City Council. Friends on the council asked her to be a candidate for appointment by the council to the Denver Civil Service Commission. She agreed, enthusiastically, but when the retiring incumbent decided to seek one more 2-year term, she withdrew her candidacy. The incumbent suggested that she would be an ideal successor 2 years hence. 2 years later, she was again approached about her interest in the appointment and agreed to have her name submitted. Once again, the incumbent decided to seek reappointment. This time, Kelly decided to stay in the game and let the council decide what to do. With the appointment pending, a newspaper story detailed how the Civil Service Commission had approved the hiring of a police recruit with an extensive history of drug use, domestic violence, and theft from an employer. The ensuing crisis put the commission on the defensive. The media and some self-styled reformers called for change. The brouhaha transformed Kelly's pending appointment into a symbol of reform on the commission, even though it was uncertain which way the incumbent had voted on the approval of the recruit. For an entire week, the newspapers and radio talk shows focused on some aspect of the story. Kelly figured prominently in all the stories, but only through comments from others about her. Reporters called her. They pressed her to comment on her vision for the commission and her views on the approved appointment of the recruit. She wanted to define herself and felt flattered to be thought of as a force for reform. Moreover, she had a hard time restraining herself from responding to the personal criticism she received from those who defended the recruit or who favored the reappointment of the incumbent to the commission. But Kelly stayed quiet. She declined to be interviewed and refused to take part in discussions on talk radio. Eventually, the council appointed Kelly by a 7-4 vote. She survived because she resisted the temptation to collude with those who wanted to make her a symbol of reform. Otherwise, she would have cast the incumbent negatively and would have created sympathy for him among the council members who had served with him and considered him a friend and colleague. Kelly even held back from responding to public criticism, because that would have made her, personally, a larger part of the story. She tried hard to separate herself from the issue by refusing to take a public position on the hiring of the recruit, even though she had a clear viewpoint on the matter. By staying outside the fray, she kept the dispute as external to her as she could, and kept it located within the commission itself, where it belonged. This increased her chances of winning the appointment and allowed her greater flexibility once she came aboard. It's a common ploy to personalize the debate over issues as a strategy for taking you out of action. You want to respond when you are attacked, or in Kelly's case, set up to be the attacker. You want to leap into the fray when you are mischaracterized or pigeonholed as embodying someone else's issues. But by resisting attempts to personalize the issues, perhaps by fighting the urge to explain yourself, you can improve the odds of your survival. You prevent people from turning you into the issue, and you help keep the responsibility for the work where it ought to be. Marty received the first, most powerful, and most painful lesson on placing the issue in the right location early in his professional life. He was fresh out of law school. His friend and mentor, Elliot Richardson, had been elected lieutenant governor and hired him to be the research and legislative assistant on his small 5-person staff. One day, about 3 months into the job, Richardson asked Marty to do some research on an issue now long forgotten. Marty did the work, and later that week turned in a memo. A couple of hours later, it came back to him. Richardson had not written a word on it, not even a pencil mark, nothing to show that he had even looked at it. Marty assumed it had come back by mistake and returned it to Richardson's secretary, asking her to send it to him again. Before he had returned to his desk a short distance away, Marty's intercom was buzzing. "Come in here," Richardson said. The boss didn't sound happy. Marty found Richardson formidable even when he was in a good mood. An angry Richardson completely intimidated him. When Marty entered the inner sanctum, he saw Richardson's jaw set firmly. He knew he was in for a lecture. "Is this your best work?" Richardson asked. "I don't know," Marty mumbled. "Well, I don't think it is. I can only add about 5% on your best work. It's a waste of my time to have to add more than that. So don't send it back in until it's the best you can produce." Richardson located the issue right where it ought to have been, squarely on Marty's shoulders. He did not take it up himself, even though it would not have taken much time or effort to fix the memo. That would have been a technical solution to an adaptive problem. How to get his new young staff person to work at a higher level. Both the critical factions existed within Marty himself. The faction that wanted to do the very best work, and the faction, which too often won out, that was happy to settle for something perfectly okay, but less than the best he could do. The worst-case scenario in assuming the conflicts and adaptive work of other people occurs when you place yourself directly in the line of fire. That's what happened to Mark Willis at the Times Mirror Company. After a successful tenure as vice chairman of General Mills, the giant food and cereal conglomerate, Mark Willis became CEO of Times Mirror on June 1, 1995. His goals were to cut losses, increase profitability, and raise the price of the company's stock. In fairly short order, he presided over the closing of the Baltimore Evening Sun, closed New York Newsday, sold off the company's legal and medical publishing operations, got rid of some cable operations, and in the process, fired over 2,000 Time Mirror employees, all of which earned him the nickname Serial Killer. With the newly found cash, however, he was able to buy back stock, boosting share price, and then buy some time from his board and from Wall Street. Willis's longer-term strategy focused primarily on the Los Angeles Times newspaper, the flagship property of the corporation. He named himself publisher of the paper in October 1997. He had ambitious, unconventional, and provocative plans, which he proclaimed at every opportunity, both within the newspaper and to national media. He intended to significantly boost readership at a time when dominant metropolitan newspapers around the country were cutting back on circulation because new readers were more expensive in terms of print and distribution costs than they were attractive to advertisers. He would attract these new readers by creating a separate Latino desk and by collaborating with small Los Angeles-based Latino and Asian newspapers. Willis ordered coverage that would have as its objective improving literacy among elementary school children so that they were more likely to become newspaper readers as adults. He even talked about, but never implemented, tying editors' compensation to the number of times women and minorities were quoted in articles under their jurisdiction. All of these steps challenged conventional journalistic values about the sanctity of the editorial product and its separation from commercial considerations. But the most radical idea, which he trumpeted loudly, was to blow apart the traditional thick wall that separated the news and business sides of the organization. In his initial and dramatic effort to cross this divide, he assigned a business side person to each of the senior editors, with the goal of working together to increase profitability. He was trying to create a partnership between factions that had traditionally remained at arm's length from each other in mutual suspicion, if not outright hostility. Willis had gained some support for this objective from his board, from sales and marketing, and even from a few folks on the editorial side. But Willis was not a journalist, and he had never worked in a news organization. Everyone knew Willis was boss, but most people on the news side of the organization saw him as an outsider trying to change a deeply held value within the newsroom. From their perspective, collaborating with the business side threatened their independence and integrity, and because it was Willis's cause, they aimed their firepower at him, not at their colleagues in circulation and advertising. The board had invested heavily in his strategy and its success. They backed him initially, and Willis survived the first couple of skirmishes. He met with enormous criticism from both inside the Times newsroom and from national media watchers. Some industry people acknowledged that he was raising important issues and appropriately challenging previously unquestioned assumptions. However, Willis had clearly moved out on the limb alone, and people were watching him closely, both inside and outside his own organization. Having survived the initial attacks, in mid-1999, Willis turned the publisher's job over to a protege from outside the newspaper. The stock price had moved steadily upward, and the board had rewarded him handsomely. Then, in the fall of that year, the Times made a deal to split the advertising revenue from a special edition of its Sunday magazine with the Staples Center, the new sports and convention facility that was the subject of the special issue. Such an arrangement was way outside conventional practices, and a firestorm of protest erupted inside the newsroom and from national newspaper watchers. The editor assigned a respected reporter to do a lengthy investigation of how the deal came about, and the publisher had to make a very public apology to calm the waters. The criticism focused on whether the Staples Center deal was the inevitable result of Willis's aggressive drive to smash the separation of news and advertising domains. The public critics included Otis Chandler, scion of the family that started the paper, and Willis's predecessor as CEO. Less than 6 months later, Willis was out of a job. The Chandler family, which controlled the board, sold the company out from under him without even letting him know that negotiations were underway. Even though they had rewarded him when the stock rose, he didn't realize how his strategy, or more precisely, how he implemented his strategy, might make him expendable when the heat rose. Willis had allowed himself to become the issue. He never placed the issue of the relationship between the business and editorial sides of the organization in the newsroom. He never made collaboration with business employees a subject of debate among the news employees, forcing editors and reporters to come to grips with current realities, to question each other, and explore their own conflicting assumptions. He did not even try to orchestrate the conflict between the news and business factions in order to generate greater mutual understanding. As long as he was willing to take it all on himself, most people on both sides were happy to sit back and watch the war between him and the traditional journalists and see who would survive. Make your interventions short and simple. Exercising leadership involves interventions. These need to be both strategic and tailored to the particular situation. Generally, short and straightforward interventions are more likely to be heard and to be accepted without causing dangerous resistance. Four types of interventions constitute the tactics of leadership: making observations, asking questions, offering interpretations, and taking actions. In practice, they are often combined with one another. Which you choose will depend on your own skills, your particular purpose, and your assessment of which intervention is most likely to move the organization's work forward and leave you unscarred. The interventions you make will, of course, be calculated to have different effects. Some are meant to calm, and others to disrupt. Some will attract attention, and others deflect it. And there will always be unintended effects. When Franklin Roosevelt said during the depth of the Depression in his first inaugural address, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," he was making an interpretation of the emotional state of the nation and its paralyzed economy. He intended to calm the nation, and followed by an action-filled 100 days, he succeeded. On the other hand, in his famous malaise speech at the height of the 1979 oil crisis, Jimmy Carter said the nation was also suffering from a crisis of confidence. Carter was making an interpretation that the problems of the country lay in the attitudes of the people themselves. At first, he was very well received, and his poll numbers jumped 11%. But 2 days later, he fired his entire cabinet. In facing both of these crises, The country needed their president to provide a strong holding environment, to be a rock of stability. If the people were going to take up his challenge, they needed to trust him. By firing his cabinet, Carter suggested he had no trust in his own administration. If he had no confidence, why should they? Carter, then, became the crisis. Observations. Observations are simply statements that reflect back to people their behavior or attempt to describe current conditions. They shift the group momentarily onto the balcony so they can get a little distance from and perspective on what they are doing. For example, when a heated argument breaks out in a meeting, someone might say, "Wait a second. It seems to me the tensions are getting really high here. Everything was going fine until Bob's comment." In and of themselves, observations are no more than snapshots from the balcony. For that reason, observations tend to be less threatening and less catalytic than other interventions, although simply calling time out and reporting what you see may be stimulating and productive. Questions. When making an observation, you can either let it rest, letting the group fill the void, or go a step further with a question or an interpretation. A question such as, "What's going on here?" or "Was there something in what Bob said that was disturbing?" may have the effect of giving the work back to the group. You might use a question because you really do not know the answer and therefore cannot render an interpretation. You might simply think it is important for people to address the issue on their own. Or you might use a question because you want to stay as much out of the line of fire as possible, while still getting the issue addressed. Of course, when you inject your understanding of events into the way you frame the question, it becomes a loaded question. Frequently, this ploy annoys people unnecessarily. Rather than simply making your interpretation of events available for discussion, people sense that you are trying to manipulate them into assuming your interpretation is true, and then starting the discussion where your assumptions leave off. Interpretations. A bolder and generally more useful alternative to a loaded question is to follow an observation with an interpretation. For example, instead of merely observing and asking about the fight, you might say, "I don't think this conflict is really about X. I think it's really about Y, a separate issue that's been simmering in our meetings for the last 4 months. Until we resolve that issue, I don't see how we can make progress on this one." This technique might be useful if you had been worried for some time about a hidden issue, but wanted to wait until either more data or a relevant situation surfaced. In offering an interpretation, you may not be fully certain of its accuracy. Clues on that score will be forthcoming from the response. Offer the interpretation, then hold steady and listen for the way the group treats your perspective. Interpretations are inherently provocative and raise the heat. People by and large do not like to have their statements or actions interpreted unless they like your assessment. When you make an interpretation, you reveal that you have spent some time on the balcony, and that makes people suspicious that you are not on the team. They may think you are somehow above them. Actions. Every action has an immediate effect, but sends a message as well. Actions communicate. For example, when someone walks out of the room during a meeting, you lose that person's contribution. But the departure also communicates messages, such as, "You're not addressing the key issues I see," or, "This conversation is too tense for me." Actions as interventions can complicate situations because they frequently are susceptible to more than one interpretation. For example, when the United Nations coalition invaded Iraqi-controlled Kuwait in January 1991, the message to Saddam Hussein was pretty clear. But what message was being sent to the rest of the nations in the Middle East? Could they too rely on UN intervention to protect their borders? Was the United States declaring a more active commitment to peace in the region? Did the alliance with Syria represent a temporary marriage of convenience or a shift in relations with ongoing relevance to regional politics? The protests of 1968 illustrate the complexity of communicating through action. The beating of men and women by Chicago policemen during the 1968 Democratic National Convention did not help the cause of the anti-Vietnam War protesters. Inadvertently, it probably helped the more hawkish presidential candidate, Richard Nixon, win the election. It made the Democratic Party look chaotic and unable to manage its members, a party of rioters and overzealous police, especially since Democratic stalwart Mayor Richard Daley was responsible for law enforcement in the city. As attempted leadership interventions, the protests failed to highlight the issues clearly and place the work where it belonged. The protests took place in a political context in which the president who was held responsible for the war, Lyndon Johnson, had already withdrawn from the presidency. The Chicago police used violence unnecessarily and outrageously, but both sides acted provocatively, and neither side was directly connected to the issue. Chicago cops versus a group of kids led by adults, most of whom were beyond military draft age. Rather than draw attention to the tough issues facing the society, the protesters created a side issue, law and order. The actions were easily misinterpreted and the work easily displaced as the television audience watched the proxies battle it out on a side issue. In other words, the protests failed to instill in the American public a sense of responsibility for the war. Not all actions send ambiguous messages. When Martin Luther King Jr. and his strategists marched from Selma, they sent a clear message illustrating the brutality of racism in America. Black people would have to choose between passive compliance and protest. White people would have to face the contradiction between the values the country stood for and the values it actually lived. In this case, action as intervention spoke far more powerfully than other modes of communication. Televised scenes of white police beating peaceful black men, women, and children forced images into the national consciousness. Millions of citizens in their living rooms across the country got the message. Actions draw attention, but the message and the context must be crystal clear. If not, they are likely to distract people, who may then displace responsibility. You stay alive in the practice of leadership by reducing the extent to which you become the target of people's frustrations. The best way to stay out of range is to think constantly about giving the work back to the people who need to take responsibility. Place the work within and between the factions who are faced with the challenge, and tailor your interventions so they are unambiguous and have a context. In the ongoing improvisation of leadership, in which you act, assess, take corrective action, reassess, and intervene again, you can never know with certainty how an intervention is received unless you listen over time. Therefore, just as critical as the quality of your actions will be your ability to hold steady in the aftermath in order to evaluate how to move next. Chapter 7. Hold steady. We've explored why adaptive work generates heat and resistance, the forms of danger this resistance takes, and how to respond. But taking action to manage political relationships, orchestrate the conflict, or give back the work assumes that you are able to meet a more basic challenge, maintaining your poise so that you can plan the best next step. Holding steady in the heat of action is an essential skill for staying alive and keeping people focused on the work. The pressure on you may be almost unbearable, causing you to doubt both your own capacities and your direction. If you waver or act prematurely, your initiative can be lost in an instant. Take the heat. Learning to take the heat and receive people's anger in a way that does not undermine your initiative is one of the toughest tasks of leadership. When you ask people to make changes and even sacrifices, it's almost inevitable that you will frustrate some of your closest colleagues and supporters, not to mention those outside your faction. Your allies want you to calm things down, at least for them, rather than stir things up. As they put pressure on you to back away, drop the issue, or change the behavior that upsets them, you will feel the heat, uncomfortably. In this sense, exercising leadership might be understood as disappointing people at a rate they can absorb. No two people are wired exactly alike, and so we all respond differently to our environment. Some of us have a higher tolerance for heat and stress than others. Indeed, there are those who thrive under peak pressure. But for most of us, who prefer to minimize opposition or avoid it altogether, the truth is that rarely, if ever, can we escape people's anger when leading any kind of significant change. Thus, the more heat you can take, the better off you will be in keeping your issue alive and keeping yourself in the game. As we saw in Chapter 5, Henry Fonda's character took intense heat from his fellow jurors in 12 Angry Men. They attacked him verbally and threatened him physically, hoping to get him to back down. His willingness to be the skunk at the lawn party and then to take the heat gracefully was essential to keeping himself and the legitimacy of his position alive in that jury room. Increasing your capacity for taking the heat takes practice. Again and again, you must train yourself to be deliberate and keep your cool when the world around you is boiling. Silence is a form of action. For over a decade, Mary Selecki administered public health programs for a three-county health district in rural northeast Washington state. She also played an active role statewide at the forefront of several successful legislative initiatives, including the AIDS Omnibus Act, which required local health agencies to provide AIDS-related services, as well as the law establishing the State Department of Health. Her success led to her appointment as Acting Secretary of Health for the state of Washington on October 1, 1998, when Governor Gary Locke made her the head of the agency she helped to create. From the moment of her appointment, she found herself in the midst of a ferocious ongoing controversy over whether people who tested HIV positive should be reported to the department by name or by a unique numerical code. AIDS activists argued adamantly that the reporting should be by numbers to protect the identity of the patients and to encourage people to be tested for HIV. Public health officials insisted that the interests of public health required that names be used. They argued that this was the simplest and most accurate system to administer, and that it could more quickly and easily track the spread of the disease, better facilitate counseling and notification, and more effectively protect against further infections. Reporting by name was the standard procedure for the other 54 illnesses on the state's list of reportable diseases. The previous February, the Governor's Council on HIV and AIDS, dominated by AIDS workers and activists, voted overwhelmingly, 14-4, in favor of using numerical identifiers. Supporters of numbers expected the governor to accept the recommendation and pass it on with his approval to the State Board of Health, which had the statutory responsibility for adopting regulations governing the reporting of diseases. The governor enjoyed widespread support in the gay community, which made up the core of the pro-numbers constituency, and he had been a strong privacy advocate throughout his political career. Instead, the governor stuck with his neutral position. He tried to form an ad hoc committee to resolve the issue, but was not able to put together a group that would be acceptable to both sides. Finally, he asked the State Board of Health to settle the matter, which then placed it on the agenda for a preliminary vote at the board's October meeting. The board consisted of 10 gubernatorial appointees, all members of the health professions. Selecki served as an ex officio member of the board, and therefore would have to cast her vote on this highly divisive issue just 2 weeks after coming into the job. Although she did not chair the board, as state health secretary, her words and actions would have a strong impact on the proceedings. In her previous job at the county level, Selecki sided with her public health colleagues in favor of using names, but now she found herself in a different environment. She had a new role with different responsibilities, a new mix of constituencies, and little guidance from her appointing authority. She assumed that Locke knew she had earlier taken a public position on the question at hand. There would be a discussion and a vote at the board meeting, and Selecki would have to declare herself. The board's vote would not be final, but it would serve as the basis of a draft rule, subject to further discussion and public hearings. There would be considerable political momentum behind whatever position it took. As the meeting date approached, Selecki gave no indication of her plans, though her staff was heavily weighted toward reporting by name. At the meeting, the extensive pre-vote discussion made it clear that the public health professionals, supporting names-based reporting, had done their homework. Selecki said nothing throughout the conversation. She waited until some but not all of the council members had voted. All eyes were on her. She abstained. The vote was 7-0 for names-based reporting, and Selecki's department was now charged with drafting a preliminary rule reflecting that vote. Her action, or inaction, upset almost everyone. Both sides expressed disappointment that she did not vote with them, but they agreed on one thing. She had abdicated her responsibility. The governor's office also expressed concern. Selecki endured a trying period in the aftermath of that meeting. Criticism came at her from many quarters. Outraged AIDS activists protested with public demonstrations, but Selecki took the heat and held steady, refusing to cave in or even to respond to the pressure to take a stand. Then, slowly and hesitatingly at first, she began to meet with the two sides, first separately and then together. Neither felt happy with what she had done, but both would have been much more upset if she had sided with the other. Eventually, they came to a compromise. The names of people infected with HIV would be destroyed after 90 days. Local health authorities would record the names, but would provide the state only with numerical identifiers. Selecki found herself tested here, not for the technical aspects of the issue, the right or wrong of policy options, but rather for her tolerance for taking heat. She had to willingly incur everyone's anger and disappointment, and then absorb it. Her old public health colleagues had every reason to think her views on the issue would remain consistent with those she had taken previously, and the AIDS activists had known her and the governor to be sympathetic to their cause. She found it difficult to get through that period. She had to absorb intense criticism from people whose friendship, collegiality, and support she had valued and enjoyed in the past. By holding steady, however, she retained access to everyone and eventually found a way to get the two sides to face each other and to accept the legitimacy of each other's concerns. Taking heat from your friends and allies is very tough. In a way, it's easier to tolerate abuse from the opposition. After all, you know you must be doing something good if the forces of evil are after you, calling you names. The people who speak in front of an angry crowd or submit to interviews on a hostile talk radio show may appear especially courageous, but those who have been in that role know the ameliorating secret. When the enemy throws tomatoes in your face, a part of you feels ennobled and reaffirmed. As Henry Fonda's character and Mary Selecki illustrate, the challenge of exercising leadership often involves taking intense heat from people whose support you value and need. Neither of them could have accomplished their aims without the help of those they were frustrating and disappointing. To withstand such pressure demands a broad perspective and extra measures of patience, maturity, courage, strength, and grace. The people you challenge will test your steadiness and judge your worthiness by your response to their anger, not unlike teenagers who want to know that they can blow hot without blowing their parents away. Receiving people's anger without becoming personally defensive generates trust. If you can hold steady long enough, remaining respectful of their pains and defending your perspective without feeling you must defend yourself, you may find that in the ensuing calm, relationships become stronger. History delights in people who demonstrate this capacity. Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi, Margaret Sanger, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Joan of Arc, Mohammed, Jesus, Moses, all gained extraordinary credibility and moral authority by receiving anger with grace. Receiving anger, then, is a sacred task because it tests us in our most sensitive places. It demands that we remain true to a purpose beyond ourselves and stand by people compassionately, even when they unleash demons. Taking the heat with grace communicates respect for the pains of change. Let the issues ripen. In your efforts to lead a community, you will often be thinking and acting ahead of them. But if you get too far ahead, raising issues before they are ready to be addressed, you create an opportunity for those you lead to sideline both you and the issue. You need to wait until the issue is ripe, or ripen it yourself. True, patience is not a virtue typically associated with people passionate about what they are doing, but holding off until the issue is ready may be critical in mobilizing people's energy and getting yourself heard. Of course, most organizations and communities have a whole spectrum of challenges confronting them at any given time. Common sense tells us we can't tackle them all at once. The availability of resources often dictates the agenda. We attack a problem when we have the wherewithal to do so. But resources are just one factor in determining the willingness of people to tackle an issue. The primary factor consists of the psychological readiness to weigh priorities and take losses. The political question becomes, has the psychological readiness spread across enough factions in the organization or community to provide a critical mass? An issue becomes ripe when there is widespread urgency to deal with it. Something that may seem to you to be incredibly important, requiring immediate attention, may not seem so to others in your organization, at least not at the moment. But it may become important to them in time. The activism of individuals, like Maggie Brooke, who took on alcoholism in her community, can ripen an issue over time by drawing people's attention to the contradictions in their lives. Or dramatic events, like the attacks on September 11, 2001, can immediately accelerate work on a whole set of issues. Once again, this is a matter of perspective. Think back to the story in Chapter 3 about Amanda and Brian, in which Amanda's intervention went nowhere, and Brian's almost identical comment, made a little while later, engaged the attention of the people at the meeting. You probably have had a similar experience, raising an issue in a meeting and having it fall on deaf ears, only to see the same issue come up again later and dominate the conversation. Though the process may confuse you and generate dismay, notice the outcome. The issue became ripe. The history of the civil rights movement in America provides a powerful illustration at the national level. By 1965, after 10 years of demonstrations, the civil rights movement had succeeded in creating national demand for civil rights legislation. They had ripened the issue by using demonstrations to draw attention to the unlived values in America. Yet in many parts of the South, black people still could not vote. In spite of the historic 1964 Civil Rights Act, the issue of voting rights had not yet ripened. The 1964 legislation had avoided the issue intentionally. It was one thing to let black people onto white buses and into white restaurants and bathrooms, but quite another to give black people access to power. The men and women who allowed themselves to be beaten by Alabama policemen in the 1965 voting rights marches in Selma ripened the issue, not only because they built upon previous progress, but also because they illustrated the problem of racial injustice clearly and dramatically. By keeping the demonstrations peaceful, no one could turn this into a law and order issue. The organizers made sure the television cameras were capturing scenes for the American audience. and the demonstrations themselves showed the problem's central stakeholders playing their roles: black adults who were of voting age, and white officials standing in their way. Having galvanized widespread political will, the demonstrations cleared the way for President Lyndon Johnson, who quickly seized the opportunity to send before Congress what soon became the 1965 Voting Rights Act. In the United States, drug abuse surfaced as a ripe issue during the late 1980s and early 1990s. Global warming, poverty, and health care did not. Health care surfaced briefly in 1993 to 1994, but the new Clinton administration formulated a solution that was so far beyond any prevailing conception of the problem that it never stood a chance. Yet Clinton's massive initiative did sow the seeds for future steps. Several years later, pieces of the issue, the plight of uninsured children, the high cost of prescription drugs for seniors, and accessibility for all, began to gain momentum. What determines when or whether an issue becomes ripe? How does it take on a generalized urgency shared by not just one, but many factions within the community? Although there are many factors, we have identified four key questions. What other concerns occupy the people who need to be engaged? How deeply are people affected by the problem? How much do people need to learn? And what are the senior authority figures saying about the issue? First, what else is on people's minds? If most of the people in your organization are handling a crisis, you may have greater difficulty getting them to shift their attention to the issue you think is most important. Sometimes you can get a better hearing by postponing your issue to a later time. During the Persian Gulf War in early 1991, the attention of many nations in the world focused on the Middle East. In these nations, issues other than the Middle East could not compete for popular attention. No other problems were going to be seriously addressed. In contrast, at the same time, within the former Soviet Union, the stirrings of a capitalist economy began to raise expectations. A growing discontent would threaten the fledgling capitalist economy if the Soviets could not meet the expectations of citizens to provide basic commodities at reasonable prices. Yet because of the Gulf crisis, you would have found it extraordinarily difficult to get a serious hearing in the NATO countries for the predicament of the Soviets. And conversely, because of the economic crisis in the former Soviet Union, you would have found it extraordinarily difficult to get the Soviet people to concern themselves with peace in the Middle East. Sometimes you have to hold steady and watch for the opportunity. However, if you notice that there is never a time for your issue, you may have to create the opportunity by developing a strategy for generating urgency. When Lyndon Johnson told Martin Luther King Jr., after passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that he would have to wait years before anyone would be ready to act on voting rights, King replied that black people had waited too long already, and that he would begin marching in Selma the following January. Johnson advised against it, but told King that if he and the organizers could raise public urgency, Johnson would use the presidency to seize the moment, which he did. Second, how deeply are people affected by the problem? If people do not feel the pinch of reality, they are unlikely to feel the need to change. Why should they? Sometimes fortuitous events ripen an issue by heightening the severity of a problem. Used properly, a crisis can provide a teaching moment. For example, when President Richard Nixon and Postmaster General Winton Blunt tried in 1969 to reverse 200 years of political patronage at the U.S. Post Office by turning it into a government corporation, few people cared enough about the issue to support such massive reform. Post Office patronage was close to the hearts of the members of Congress, who, after all, were going to have to vote on the proposal. but members of Congress were hearing from every postal employee in their district about the need for a pay raise, and very little from anyone at home about the need for reorganization. A wildcat walkout of postal workers in New York City, followed by a nationwide strike to demand a pay raise, changed all that. Most people, particularly business people, felt an immediate and devastating impact. Millions of dollars were lost. Important documents fell into limbo, and Social Security checks were delayed. There were threats of a court order, and on March 23, 1970, Nixon threatened to send in the National Guard to deliver the mail. Bringing in the military had the effect of breaking the strike, and most postal workers were back on the job by March 25. The postal strike became the number one news story throughout the country. It affected almost everyone. Because the public largely supported postal pay raises, the administration feared that the strike would actually set back reform efforts. What they had not anticipated was that the strike brought home to people just how dependent they were on a smoothly functioning postal service. Because the public had felt the effects of the mail's disruption, the administration was able to pressure the unions to link the pay bill with union support for reform. And on August 6, 1970, the Congress sent a pay raise reorganization package to the White House. Although the strike was not about the reorganization of the post office, the disruption in people's lives made the issue of post office operation salient. People felt they had experienced the problem, and for the first time wanted something done to ensure that delivery of the mail would be in the hands of capable professionals. Events ripened the issue of nuclear safety in 1978, when the reactors at Three Mile Island began to melt down. For many years, warnings about the danger of a nuclear energy plant meltdown had come only from marginalized interest groups, long identified as anti-nuclear. Their claims were not taken seriously, and an energy-guzzling public eagerly accepted the assurances from government and industry that all was safe and well. After that frightening incident, the claims of the nuclear power industry regarding the safety of nuclear energy plants sounded very different than they had before. Even though no deaths and apparently very little significant long-term damage resulted from it. Coincidentally, the film The China Syndrome, a fictitious account of a nuclear power plant disaster, was released at the same time as the incident, ripening the issue further. Building nuclear power plants suddenly became highly problematic. The issue of safety versus the need for more energy had ripened. People began to face the trade-offs. Third, how much must people learn in order to make judgments? The lack of knowledge on an issue is almost always in direct proportion to its lack of ripeness. A crisis can change this quickly. The risks of nuclear power were not well understood until the accidents at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. Those incidents generated public learning in short order. On an even larger scale, the events of September 11, 2001 and their aftermath schooled the nation, and to a significant extent the world community, on the grave risks and potential consequences of terrorism, and the need for new international norms and cooperation. By contrast, global warming is an issue that is slowly, gradually impressing itself on the public consciousness. As weather patterns change and new trends emerge, affecting people's lives, education increases and the issue develops. No doubt a teaching moment will develop in this area, when we experience a string of catastrophic and weird weather events with losses of life and property. Because crises and tragedies generate the urgency to tackle issues, sometimes the only way to bring focus to an issue and move it forward is to create a crisis. These can be small, like budget crises, which are often available to draw attention to the need to reevaluate priorities and direction. Or they can be large. Martin Luther King Jr. lived in constant fear for his life. But in Selma, he deliberately created a situation that was almost certain to result in violence. He knew he was putting not only his own life at risk, but many other lives as well. The marchers understood the dangers, to be sure, but that did not make King's decision any easier, particularly when three people were killed. If you do not take into consideration how difficult the learning will be, the organization or community will box you off as an outsider, impractical visionary, or worse. You may have to take baby steps. It may take years to ripen the issue in an organization to the point that people understand what is at stake and can decide their fate. As we saw in Chapter 1, the IBM corporate culture of 1994 did not recognize the new challenge of business on the Internet. At that time, IBM operated from a full agenda that had no place for dealing with it. People were busy with other things. So it was up to engineer Grossman, middle manager Patrick, and other volunteers with little authority to ripen the issues in baby steps over a 5-year period. Fourth, what are the people in authority saying and doing? Although the rhetoric and even the commitment of authorities often are not enough by themselves to ripen an issue, they always figure significantly. Formal authority confers license and leverage to direct people's attention. Notice an important distinction between the U.S. Post Office reorganization and Selma. With the Post Office, the Nixon administration took advantage of a tangential event to focus attention on an issue and thus make it ripe for political action. But in Selma, King took the initiative himself to ripen the issue. Worse than lacking authority, King had to challenge authorities across the nation, first the Alabama police, then the federal court, and finally the Congress. The less ready a group is to resolve an issue, the more you may need to challenge authority. Of course, King also had a major ally among the nation's authorities, namely Lyndon Johnson, the president. So you might ask, shouldn't the president have just taken the lead and persuaded Congress it was wrong to keep black people from voting? After all, people expect their authorities to persuade people to do what they should do. Furthermore, society has formal rules and procedures for authorities to take charge. The person running the meeting prepares an agenda. The president gives a State of the Union message. The head of the labor union proposes a set of target goals for the upcoming negotiation. If you are the person in authority, you are not only expected to set the agenda, but also to select the issues that warrant attention. You cannot keep your authority in your organization if you insist on projects that your organization opposes. In other words, those who have authority put it at risk by seeking to raise unripe issues. For example, while jogging before dawn during his first week in the White House in 1993, Bill Clinton felt cornered by reporters to comment on gays in the military. By taking a stand long before the public, Congress, or the military had had the chance to work through this issue, Clinton inadvertently became a lightning rod and created a spectacle. Forced to expend an enormous amount of energy on developing and defending his position, he sacrificed a significant measure of the credibility and goodwill he needed to establish other priorities and launch his presidency. In contrast, Lyndon Johnson approached civil rights strategically. He did not move out front to take a stand. Instead, he helped other people ripen the issue, so that his hands were free to orchestrate the ensuing conflict. For example, to gain enough Republican votes to end a filibuster by Southern Democrats on the 1964 Civil Rights Bill, Johnson personally prodded Roy Wilkins and other civil rights leaders to woo Senator Everett Dirksen, the Republican leader, with the possibility of black electoral support in the coming presidential election and beyond. Johnson was in no way authorized to be a behind-the-scenes civil rights strategist, advising activists on techniques for winning Republican support. If he had been exposed, he would have lost credibility. He went outside his authority, but he did so in a way that minimized the risk of undermining his position. He did not, for example, hold a press conference in which he declared the priority of civil rights. He helped others ripen the issue. For people exercising leadership without or beyond their authority, ripening an issue becomes more difficult, requiring more dramatic and therefore riskier steps. For example, in a meeting for which the chairperson has set the agenda, you decide that your best chance for drawing attention to an important issue is to put yourself forward and change the course of the meeting. When the time for new business comes, you stand up and start to speak. At that moment, you become the center of attention, a likely lightning rod for and personal embodiment of the issue. Parties on different sides of the issue will perceive you as a threat, upsetting the status quo. Some will likely move to restore equilibrium by finding a way to silence your voice, perhaps by criticizing your style or noting that the meeting is running late. Perhaps they will look to authority to fend off the challenge. But if you hold steady, taking the immediate heat and keeping your intervention short and clear, your odds of success increase. Your position may be heard, and people may respect you for putting yourself on the line. If you back down quickly, you merely reinforce your lack of credibility. Focus attention on the issue. Getting people to focus their attention on tough problems can be a complicated and difficult task, particularly in large organizations or communities where typically ways of avoiding painful issues, work avoidance mechanisms, have developed over many years. The most obvious example of work avoidance is denial. Even our language is full of shorthand reminders of this mechanism. Out of sight, out of mind. Swept under the carpet. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Other typical work avoidance mechanisms are seeking a big man to fix things, scapegoating, reorganizing yet again, passing the buck, setting up another committee, finding an external enemy, blaming authority, character assassination, and physical assassination. Actual physical assassination usually represents an extreme act of work avoidance. These mechanisms reduce the level of distress in an organization or community by deflecting attention from the tough issues and shifting responsibility away from the people who need to change. In leading, you need to hold steady in the face of these distractions, counteract them, and then redirect attention and responsibility to the issue at hand. In an important sense, this book is about sensing and counteracting work avoidance mechanisms that will endanger you and your organization. Again, a person in authority can more easily redirect attention than someone lower on the ladder. Typically, authority figures have established mechanisms for focusing attention, calling a meeting, sending a memo, holding a press conference. However, these methods do not always succeed. If you employ a routine mechanism for getting attention, people may well see the problem as routine and ignore it. So even with authority, you need to find creative ways to signal that the new situation is different. When John Lehman became Secretary of the Navy in 1981, he faced the very big challenge of reasserting the Navy's control over its major contractors, including General Dynamics and its subsidiary, Electric Boat, which built Navy submarines. Electric Boat had not delivered any of the ships promised in 1980, and the company was incurring huge cost overruns, which it wanted the Navy to absorb. This was both a money issue and a production issue for Lehman, who had made creating a 600-ship Navy the key goal of his tenure. He needed General Dynamics to back off on its financial claims and to dramatically speed up its work, and he knew that neither would happen without putting some pressure on the company. Initially, Lehman used conventional strategies to try to focus the attention of key parties on the issue. He sent a vice admiral to testify at a congressional hearing. He called David Lewis, the CEO of General Dynamics, to the Pentagon and told him he was canceling a request for bids on new attack submarines and negotiating sole source contracts with Lewis's only competitor, intent on avoiding responsibility for its delays and cost overruns. General Dynamics counterattacked in predictable fashion, revving up support from its favorite senators and representatives. These included the late John Chafee, Republican of Rhode Island, himself a former Navy secretary, whose state of Rhode Island reaped significant economic benefits from the presence of Electric Boat in Groton, Connecticut, close to the Rhode Island border. Chafee dragged Lehman out to Groton and forced Lehman to speak in a more conciliatory tone, lest he alienate a key senatorial ally. Back and forth it went throughout most of the spring and summer. There were meetings, reports, threats, and counter-threats, most of them reported in the press. Lehman seemed to vacillate, sounding critical, offering an olive branch, and then taking it away. Lewis and Lehman were engaged in an elaborate chess game, in which they both followed the rulebook fairly closely. But then, in early August, Lewis went over Lehman's head to see Presidential Counselor Edwin Meese III in the White House in an effort to get Lehman to back off. Lehman realized that unless he did something dramatic, he was in danger of losing the issue. Rather than continue the back-and-forth pattern of press conferences, meetings, and leaked memos and reports that had characterized the past 6 months, Lehman decided to make a speech at the National Press Club in Washington. The press club was a venue that would ensure broad coverage, forcing all the relevant players, General Dynamics, the White House, Congress, to take definitive steps. For the same reason, the move was extremely risky, putting his credibility squarely on the line. If he did not have enough support within the White House, the Congress, and interest groups, his strategy could backfire, resulting in a solution that would set back his objectives and undermine his tenure. The press club's speech was a major departure from routine. Ordinarily, someone in Lehman's position might never give an address there. The coverage of the speech, which Lehman followed up with an op-ed synopsis in the Washington Post, forced all those involved to put the issue at the top of their agendas. For the first time since he had begun to engage the company, everyone's attention began to sharpen. A week after the speech, Lehman and Lewis had an intense and difficult meeting that led a month later to an agreement between the Navy and General Dynamics, capping the government's financial exposure and tying Electric Boat to clear performance measures in return for more work. In a more routine way of signaling the non-routine, the senior management at Xerox Corporation drew attention in the early 1990s to the enormous challenge of becoming a customer-responsive organization by holding a series of three-day retreats with their top managers. Moreover, in a period of cost containment, they hired an expensive consultant who could make the case for the need to change cultural norms. At that time, the Xerox frontline sales and service personnel had no latitude whatsoever to respond creatively and quickly to the needs of customers. Instead, they were expected to follow the rulebook, even if it meant angering clients needlessly. People down the line were controlled rather than entrusted. It would have been easy for senior management to pull people together at corporate headquarters where they interacted regularly anyway. But doing so would have signaled that the message was nothing out of the ordinary. By meeting off-site, with presentations and discussions orchestrated by outsiders